Welcome to the Appen Appen Podcast, episode 73, a podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
And I'm Jerry.
In this show, we talk about Laravel and IPv6 again.
We talk about backups and firewalls.
And we talk a little bit about cloud hosting. So without further ado, on with the show.
Jerry, I think you might have some questions about IPv6 after re-listening to the last show.
Yeah, well, I listened to the excellent episode 72, and I just thought I'd write in with a few questions.
first time. Yeah. First time listener. No, no. Yeah.
First time emailer. Yeah.
Yes.
LTL FTE, to use another podcast's vernacular. So my first question is: do your sort of standard maybe not IoT, Internet of Things type devices, or maybe, did they sort of advertise for and receive IPv6 addresses?
So, in my experience, not everything does, but a lot of devices will do. So IPv6 has been around for, coming on for 20 years, I think. And so most of the underlying network stacks know about IPv6. But yeah, it tends to be that certainly the cheaper boxes will only do IPv4. But because there's sort of becoming more of a prevalence of networks either being what they call dual stack, which is IPv4, IPv6, or in some cases, even sort of wholly IPv6 with like a proxy to IPv4 networks, they will tend to have at least a recognition of the fact they need IPv6, if only just to do resolution of names and stuff like that.
So that kind of brings me to my next question, which was, do you need to have the IP? If you've got a load of devices on your network, some are IPv4, some are IPv6, so the IPv4 ones are not IPv6 capable, can you then sort of mix and match them on the same network? Will they be able to address each other and so on?
Yeah, absolutely. So the IPv6 stuff will only be able to talk to IPv6 boxes. And the IPv4 boxes will only be able to talk to IPv4 stuff. If you've got a proxy that lives kind of in the same network, so you've got something that will talk IPv4, but also knows about IPv6, it can go and ask your IP, it can sort of do the DNS resolution and then make requests against IPv6 boxes, particularly for like web traffic and stuff like that, or for email servers and stuff like that.
So would that be so something like Squid or whatever, if you need to,
Squid, so, or Nginx, or your Exchange server will probably be able to talk it, or sort of things like that. But I think the key thing really is, and this is part of the reason why it's good to turn on IPv6 on your network, is that because they do both coexist, if you only have an IPv4 network and an IPv6 malicious node comes into your network somehow. So say, for example, one of the lovely IoT boxes you've bought is actually backdoored and is doing IPv6 router announcing. What happens is, because IPv6 tends to take precedence inside your network, because it's the newer network, if you have a malicious box that's doing IPv6, anything that understands IPv6 will go down the IPv6 tunnel first. So if you look up, you know, mybank.com, and mybank.com comes back with an IPv6 address, your traffic will go down the IPv6 path first instead of the IPv4 path. So okay, then therefore you could man in the middle and stuff like that. So it's worth having an IPv6 resolver, if only just to basically block any IPv6 traffic. That said, if you've got an IPv6 thing there and it's resolving without actually having somewhere to go to, a lot of the stuff on your network is likely to then break. So, you know, it's a chicken and egg, I think, is the best way to describe it. Yeah. The good thing is a lot of ISPs, particularly in the UK, do have IPv6 stacks. The only reason that I started doing this stuff was just because the ISP that I'm with doesn't do IPv6.
Hmm. I mean, I think my server, my dedicated server, has IPv6. It has an IPv6 address.
Yeah.
In addition to an IPv4 address. And has had for since I got it provisioned about 4 or 5 years ago now.
Yeah. So for me, really, it's more for if you've got a corporate network, you should really have an IPv6 DHCP service on there, if only just to protect your internal resources. Because aside from anything else, there's a thing called WPAD.
Web Proxy Auto-Discovery.
Yeah. And that listens, that will, if you, it'll do a DNS probe for wpad.youradomainname.com or your AD server. So if it's example.com, it'll be wpad.example.com. And so if you've got a man in the middle box that's there that will reply to your WPAD request, what it'll actually do is it will send all the traffic to your WPAD box, to the WPAD service that it resolves to then send all your web traffic out. So again, you could be have your web traffic being man in the middle by your this IPv6 malicious box there.
That's not good.
It's not. Not that I'm hoping to give sort of people any naughty ideas for their network.
Oh, so I think I had one last question again. Well, I think this is a question you might have added. Why do IPv6? You kind of started to go into it there.
Yeah, so the security thing's quite key for me. The other thing as well is that I mentioned before that it does the DNS resolution will tend to prefer IPv6 addresses first, particularly if you've got a dual stack network. So it'll try and do IPv6 DNS resolution first, and then we'll try and get to the DNS, to the response from that IPv4 DNS request. And then if it doesn't get a response to the IPv6 address, it will then fail back to the IPv4 address. So realistically, if you've got if you have anything that resolves to an IPv6 address, you'll have latency in that connection. The other thing as well, like I mentioned, is that IPv6 is the future. It's where we should be trying to swap to. You know, IPv4 is going to be exhausted at some point soon. The cost for an IPv4 address is just going to go up and up and up. Most of the networks will support it. So DigitalOcean definitely does, because I know I'm with them. I know that Azure has got some capability for doing IPv6. But the internal services tend not to be IPv6, at least not that I've seen.
I agree.
AWS, I think, will do IPv6 without too much of a problem as well. But so yeah, it's just about making sure that you've got the capability there, even if you're not necessarily doing, if you're not using it.
Have you tried connecting to your DigitalOcean bar IP6?
Yes. So all the connections that I now make to my personal stuff all tends to be via IPv6. So my home server is IPv6 and my web server is IPv6. So if I connect from my mobile phone to the DNS names that I have for my IP, for my web server or for my home server, they will go over IPv6 or tend to go via IPv6. If I'm connecting from my web server to my home server, which is very rare, it's only when I'm basically doing a test, that's always IPv6. If I'm connecting from my home server to my web server, which again tends to be pretty rare, that will tend to be IPv6.
Okay. And so, but all your traffic is going via Hurricane Electric, though, is that correct? Do they mind you doing that or not? Are there like any limit or anything on that with sending traffic via them?
I've not seen anything. So I think that what Hurricane Electric tends to do is they'll set up points of presence nodes at various of the peering networks. So when you select from the various networks, I think effectively the way that they treat it. So I don't know whether you know, but the peering arrangements tend to be that you are billed based on the amount of if you're predominantly doing outbound traffic, you get charged on the proportion of outbound over inbound traffic. And if you're predominantly doing inbound traffic, you'll be charged on the difference between the inbound over the outbound traffic. Or at least that's my understanding of it. I don't tend to do a lot with peering. But so,
isn't the idea that they sort of balance out? So you send as much traffic as you receive and you don't pay any money.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of the intention, is that if you're in this peering network anyway, you know, if you're going in and out of the same effectively in and out of the same interface, your ingress and egress traffic is going to be around about the same. You're not going to tend to be mostly going outbound, because it's just effectively, it's almost like, it's like a proxy almost in that network. You know, it's not really actually doing anything natively itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And going back to the whole thing about, like, we didn't know the WA pad thing and the domain name. So I'm thinking about changing my domain name at home, because, or my local DNS name I use, because it's .local at the moment. But there's not a problem when you've got Windows boxes, but so when you put a Linux box on there, especially Ubuntu, it doesn't like doing the .local, because what was that thing again that does with inside?
MDNS.
Yeah. So if I change it for something like .lan, will that handle it a lot better?
So that's not going to make any difference to the IPv6 stuff.
No.
But yeah, absolutely. You're right. You should avoid using .local as your internal search address. Yeah. I have localnet as my search name. But yeah, MDNS, sometimes it's sort of lumped into the UPnP, sort of same collection of things. People refer to it as the same thing. It's not the same thing. But it, yeah, MDNS is basically...
it's like service discovery, isn't it?
Almost. So whereas DNS is a unicast connection to 1, 2, or some, you know, 3, 4 DNS servers, MDNS is a broadcast-based lookup. So it sends a request out on the broadcast address for your network. So if your address is 192.168.1.1 with a /24 mask, you will be doing an MDNS lookup by sending a request on a, I can't remember what the port is, it might be 53, but equally it might be something like 1900, I can't remember. But so it's a request to 192.168.1.255, and it's basically saying, I'm looking for a host called this. And so in the same way that you do DHCP requests to that .255 address, if you do an MDNS request to that, you get a response back saying, I'm over here. And that's the same way that zeroconf works as well, loosely.
Yeah, because I had that problem where, like, it keeps local DNS resolution on your machine, doesn't it? So, like, if you even configure your PC to have a DNS server, it uses its local reference for itself first and then pulls data from, if it can't find it locally, it then goes to the your DNS server. Mm. So I've been playing with a PHP framework after we spoke on the last podcast for the CRUD, the create, what's it? Create something.
Create, read, update, delete.
Yes. And yeah, and that's exactly what I wanted to do, what I was looking for. So, is it Laravel? Do you say Laravel? Laravel?
Yeah. I've definitely heard people say Laravel.
So it's using this thing called the MVC model, And so before in the past, I've written things like this in ASP.NET and in PHP, where you write your own user control panel, your own user authentication. You write things, pull things from databases, you pull, and then you pull it back. And I wanted to do this again for the scouting I'm doing for a camp where people can go and log on, or the leaders go on long and book who, how many places they want. And then I can see how many places people have booked. And then when they send the money in, I've got a lady who can go in and basically update it. And I wanted it to be a lot more secure. So with Laravel, it uses this thing called MVC, which is Model View and Controller, which I've actually have heard in the past when I've been setting up web servers for people, but I never actually knew what it meant. But it's kind of does three things. So model is where you are defining all your things in your database, like tables and connection to your database servers. And you've got view is where you are actually pulling data or pushing data to the actual database. So like if you're pulling data and you're doing your tables, like I like to put things in tables. So like if you when you're pulling your stuff out of the database from a query, and then you can then go for your variables and then you can print them on the screen. That's called a view. And also if you're having an input, you can do the same thing. That's where you write all your code for that. And then you've got a controller, which is all of the things in the back end where you're passing your things from your form into, and it will do things like validation checks. You can do things like, once done a validation check, it will then create a record for you, or you can do it so it can pull records and all the massive things like this. And you haven't got to really learn PHP to do it. You haven't got to sit there and write queries, SQL queries, because it's all written in this kind of language. I found a really good YouTube video of a series about 12 videos. I put a link in the show notes, which basically just shows you how to write this little CRUD application. And the good thing about Laravel is there's like a whole built-in login authentication system. So you just literally just create this a model for the, which basically creates a user table, and then you just put sections in your views which say that if this user can access it, and if it can, it has to go the way and authenticate it or check if it's you're authenticated. And it's just really handy to doing all this kind of thing. So and I've also like learned so much about variables, and like you can always annoys me when you can't work out if you're putting the right if you're doing a query and it returns out of variables what they are. So you could like use var dump in PHP. I'm guessing you probably heard of that, but I hadn't heard of that before. So you can write that and then it will basically display all your variables in your query into the kind of display on your screen kind of thing. So, and also includes this thing called Bootstrap, which is basically like a predefined style sheet, so you can make it all look pretty without doing too much work. It's really good how you can, and it's all done on the back end, and all you have to do is present this folder in your Apache or Nginx config to look at this one folder, and you write all the code in back-end folders which the user never sees kind of thing. So that's what I've been up to with the old Laravel. So I think that might be my talk about it at OggCamp, if I do a talk at OggCamp about it. So
I look forward to it.
So you said you've done some stuff with MVC style applications in, no, you've done web development ASP in the past.
Yeah.
How did you find developing in PHP versus developing in ASP?
Well, I've done ASP, then I did a PHP application a couple of years ago for something small I had to do. It's just for remembering with PHP, it's just getting the semicolon at the end of it, remembering it to put that on the end of it. But luckily with this Laravel thing, it's got like a debugger thing. So if it doesn't go through and you do something wrong, it will basically like start saying like, expecting end of line or whatever. Yeah. So you can go, oh, yeah. And it like highlights a line. So you can go, oh, yeah, I forgot to put the semicolon at the end of it.
Yeah, Ansible's got things like that, and Terraform as well. It makes it quite easy to track down what you've done wrong. Yeah,
and I've spent because at the moment I'm using Laravel 5.5, which is a stable branch, and there's like 5.9 to unstable. Like it's not a lot. Sorry, it's like the long term support one, and with the 5.5, you don't get email verification on the user created. So I had to kind of get that working, and I got a bit stuck for like 3 days doing that. But some people on Slack thing for Laravel helped me out on that. So yeah, so that's all good.
So is your intention with this web application to be something that you will kind of sell, or is this going to be an open source thing that you're going to share with people, or is that kind of part of the conversation never really kind of entered your head yet?
Well, I thought about it because it's I'm guessing if you have a Scout people want to use it, then it's, yeah, I wasn't going to sell or anything. It's just kind of thing just to help me book the people on the site and stuff. So and I know other people have done it as well, kind of thing, but it's just, yeah, so I think I might, once I've got all the code working properly, I might put it on GitHub or something. So
cool. Okay.
Is it, so it's a PHP application. Do you sort of untar a load of code into a web folder, set up a database, and off you go? Is that how it works?
You have to use, it's not, is it pip? It's something you have to.
Composer. Composer for PHP.
And you basically do that and you say new project, and it creates a load of folder structure. And there's one folder in there you have to basically expose to your web server, and then the rest of the folders you don't expose. You edit one file to basically put your connections in to your database.
Right.
But you don't have to go into MySQL database or PHP MyAdmin to do anything. You basically, if you wanted to create a table and you want to say, I want to make this table name and I want to make these columns, you basically make a make file. Or a model file, sorry, and you put all that detail in there, and then you do a composite again. You just do like composite make, and then you put the model, and it goes and makes all the tables for you.
Oh, so, right.
And the code's really easy as well to kind of understand.
So here's where the old fashioned sort of PHP developer in me comes out. Are you doing anything around unit testing or functionality testing, or is it you just basically? Sort of letting, are you testing stuff locally and just kind of going, oh, that's not working the way I was expecting, I'll change it? Or are you actually doing proper things like PHP unit or sort of those sorts of testing frameworks?
Not the testing frameworks. I basically just run through with it, get someone else to check it, that they can do it.
Okay.
So what do you mean by the unit testing?
Okay. So in coding in general, you need to, well, it depends. If you are, there's some development patterns called test-driven development or behavior-driven development, which effectively recommend starting from a certain point. So, for example, with test-driven development, what you'll do is you'll say, here is my thing that I want to happen. So say, for example, I want to add a value into a table. So you write a unit test that fails that says, you know, when I visit this page with these values in them, it should inject when I run this function, it should put values into my database. So you can test before state, which is database exists but there's no values in there, and then you run the function, and then afterwards you check the table again and say, there is now a value in there. So that's kind of unit testing. There's a way of describing how you write those unit tests, which is they call behavior-driven development. which is where you have these things they call user stories. And there's a particular tool that I've seen used for that. And it's been a while since I've done PHP development. So if I get some of the names of these packages wrong, dear listener, please feel free to write in and correct me. But there's things like Cucumber.
Oh, yeah.
Which is where you have something like, as a user, if I go to the login page and click on register and fill in my details and click submit, I expect to have an email sent back to me with a login URL, or stuff like that. So that then generates the user, the unit test framework.
So it really mimics sort of plain English.
Yes.
I think I've seen these tests because the first sort of DevOpsy job I did, they did a load of Cucumber tests. I did have one of the DevOps guys saying, who switched everything to Cucumber? Because he really didn't like, I think that whole, the natural language type thing can lead to tests not working, always working the way you expect them to, and
yeah,
and so on. But yeah, I think there is a big effort with that to make those things like natural language. So InSpec is a bit like that, and I think that comes from RSpec, which must be similar.
So RSpec is the Ruby version, isn't it? I think. So, but one of the good things about particularly if you're fairly early on in this application, and again, I'm guessing you've probably got like a time limitation on this because you need to be running this camp relatively soon.
Yeah.
But if you're planning on open sourcing it, obviously you can't sort of go back in time and start from the beginning and, you know, rewrite all your code to have these tests in them and then, you know, add the code in and stuff like that. But after the camp, or, you know, when you've got some time, it's probably worth going back and writing unit tests. And the reason why that's useful is that when you get your first pull request from a member of the community, you can have what they call a continuous integration tests, so that when they so things like Travis CI or Circle CI, mm-hmm. so that when they make their pull request, it automatically runs all your unit tests and makes sure that none of those tests have been broken by the change request that comes in.
Yeah, so for collaborating on code, it's test-driven development is really good because it means that you always know that the code is doing what it's supposed to do. No matter who, how it's edited, you know, if it's edited in a way that doesn't work, then it's going to fail the test.
And the other thing that you can do as well is you can, so you've got your code tests, but you can also have what they call functional tests, which is where, and this is particularly with web applications, there's a testing framework called Selenium, where you can describe, where before I was describing that kind of, you know, as a user, when I go to this page and click here, I expect this thing to happen. With Selenium, you can actually have it have a almost like a what they call a headless browser that renders the web page. And it's usually in Firefox or Chromium or something like that. And it literally will simulate, I go to this web page, I click on a button called this in that web page, and I expect this page to be returned with this content in it. So again, you can have your code tests to confirm that the function does what you expect it to do. But equally, you can have these Selenium functional tests that say, having made these changes, the functional tests haven't broken either.
Okay.
This is, and again, you know, I don't want to completely blow your brain with this one, but these are kind of this way of approaching web development lead to better applications, and better understanding of anyone that comes into the project. Because if they want to understand how everything works. They can run the, they can look through the unit tests and they can say, you know, when I go to this page, I should be able to do this thing. You know, this is what I expect this code to do, because you've written your code in such a way that you can test, you know, an individual piece of a function. So you don't have long sprawling functions that do 65,000 things. You'll have a small function that does one thing, because you can then test that one thing.
Cool. Thank you. I'll have a look at that.
Once the scout camps are on you.
Yeah.
I see here, Al, that you've, I think you've been having some problems with certbot. Is that right?
Yeah. It's quite a long time ago and it has it, but I'll put it in the show notes when we put it in there. I was getting an email from my Let's Encrypt saying that basically couldn't have like SNI authentic or validation wasn't going to be working after the 1st of March or something. I think it was because someone found a bug, didn't they, using, basically says your Let's Encrypt client uses ACME or a TLS hyphen SNI hyphen 01 domain validation to issue a certificate. And it tells you this below it. But if you don't do it by a certain date, basically it will fail. But I understand that the way Let's Encrypt works is it does a number of ways to validate you actually own that domain, doesn't it? And I think that this SNI one, someone found a bug in it that if you've got a subdomain of a normal domain, you can kind of generate certificates for other subdomains. So I'll put a link in the show notes. I found a video on YouTube which basically explains it. But for some reason, I can't remember when I inserted certbot on my Ubuntu server, which is 16.04, that it was running 2.3 and it wasn't automatically updating to 2.8. So I had to run a command, sudo apt-get install only upgrade certbot. And that, I don't know why that only, what that means by only upgrading certbot, because I thought you could just, when you did an apt-get update, it should do it. So is it just saying that that's installing another version of certbot on there?
It sounds like maybe a badly written Debian package that,
right,
that is requiring that, maybe. I'd have to look into it to be sure.
But as soon as I did that and I had to edit the config to basically not to use SNI, and it basically came back working fine. So I haven't had any more errors about it.
Yeah, I had the same thing with, I think it was lug.org.uk. We had some problems with the TLS SNI thing, and that was because we'd installed certbot using pip instead of using apt for some reason. I think there was a valid reason for it at the time, and we ended up having to do pip install certbot -- upgrade, and that pulled the latest version down. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I think because one of the things with certbot was that when it first came out, people were trying all sorts of different ways to install it. And if you followed the wrong instructions, and that's not to say you followed the wrong instructions, but if the wrong instructions were followed, yeah, you might have ended up at a point where you had the wrong package or the wrong config or something wacky with that particular version of certbot.
I'm about to implement Let's Encrypt for a client. So I've only done it once before, really, on my own server, so should be fun. But they're still at the stage of buying certificates for all their various different sites. So I think it will make their life easier, as well as saving them quite a bit of money.
The main thing that I've found with certbot and Let's Encrypt in general is the two things that people tend to get wrong is not exposing the .well-known directory in the web server. So essentially in the root directory, there's a thing called .well, it will create a .well-known path. And if you've got redirection from say, www.mysite.com to mysite.com and then try and do certbot minus d www.mysite.com, it'll break because it can't find the .well-known directory there.
Right.
And the other thing is either over-specifying or under-specifying the domains that the certbot's trying to get certificates for. So when I was trying to set up certbot for Lug.org UK, we host a lot of web services on the same server. So I tried specifying all of these subdomains. And there are timeouts that you can hit if you get things wrong with it. And I kept doing that to the extent that basically we had to kind of hold off using Let's Encrypt for sort of a month or so whilst I was sort of trying to remember the timings and the right invocation of the command line to get it in. There's lots of help around doing that now, so it doesn't tend to be quite as bad as when I was sort of first trying it. But those are the two main things that probably you will stumble across.
So do you have to do kind of rolling updates for your certs?
No.
Is it like rate limiting?
Yeah, so they rate limit on the number of signups you can do. But I was trying to onboard something like 30 different URLs at the same time, which is not the right way to do it.
Right.
And you've got only a certain number of actions that you can fail on at any one time. So that well-known thing that I was talking about, I'm still struggling with that because of the way that the Lug.org UK infrastructure's sort of architected. And actually what we should be doing is kind of changing the way we do. Anyway, there's things under the surface in Lug.org UK that I need to fix before we can solve that problem for some of the Lug.org UK services.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
My projects I mentioned, I think, in the last podcast about the LAMP servers, I'm constantly finding things that, I wish I'd kind of architected that a bit differently, and that's going to bite me a bit later if I don't address it. And it's all going to be, because we've got like a dev and a live environment, you've got to all test it all out in dev and then push it to live. It's almost like a sort of day job. I'm thinking of setting up my own CI server to start doing that kind of thing.
Depending on sort of the scale of what it is you're doing with it, I've mentioned before Travis CI. I've also mentioned Circle CI.
Hmm.
They're both really good services for doing things like, provision, test, destroy.
Hmm.
Particularly if all that you're really trying to do is, confirm that a certain function runs in a certain way or, a test runs in a particular manner. You'd probably be better off, rather than sort of investing in a whole CI/CD pipeline, if all you actually need is just to be able to run some unit tests, or when X thing happens, trigger Y deploy job. Look at Travis or Circle; they're much easier to run. Basically just adding one line of config to your source tree, rather than having to have a whole set of services running in the background the whole time.
Yeah. It's just, I think you have to kind of be careful what you're running through it, I suppose. Make sure it's kind of anonymized and all that kind of thing.
Not necessarily. You can have sort of what they refer to as secrets that are not publicly exposed.
Hmm.
So, like, for example, you don't have to expose your web server credentials. You could quite easily have, some random anonymous name for your Git repositories, so it's not clear immediately what it is that's going in there. You can set up webhooks for things that will look for, standard patterns for, I can't even think what it's called now, API keys and stuff like that. So you can set web services up to look for stuff like that. So if somebody accidentally commits, you know, a live AWS secret key, you know, you can you can demise those secrets relatively easily.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, ultimately, it depends on kind of how protective the people that you're running that service for are. If they don't want their code in public anywhere, then yeah, you're going to need to run your own CI/CD system. But if it's an open source project or, you know, even, you know, publicly accessible code, that's, it doesn't, you know, again, so long as your secrets aren't out there, you can use something like Travis or CircleCI because the code's available on GitHub anyway. So
I'll have to have a look at those.
So you've also been doing some migrating some clients to DigitalOcean then?
Yeah, so this is another sort of freelance slash, well, maybe not so freelance. I've been spending, well, it's getting on for about 10 days with this client. And they've moved fairly recently. They started off with some dedicated servers, which they've had for, I think, quite a few years. Their stack is Java-based, and they've been on this Proxmox installation, Proxmox VE, I think it's called. Basically a system for running VMs and or LXC containers, I believe. And they've been given this by a hosting company, but it turns out it hasn't been. Either it's being configured badly by the hosting company, or they're, well, it seems that it's been configured badly because it keeps dying. They've got shared storage using Gluster, which seems to not be very performant, and keeps falling over in inopportune times. And I won't go into the nature of the business, but it's kind of time critical. So they need something a bit more stable and reliable. So they decided to go with DigitalOcean. Which is great. I use DigitalOcean all the time for prototyping things. So I'm quite familiar with how you talk to the API, you know, what kind of services are available. There aren't many with DigitalOcean, but in a way that's a good thing, because you don't get locked into using a service. Like, for instance, one of the many services that AWS provides, you end up locked into using to that way of doing things a lot of the time. With DigitalOcean, you've basically got droplets, which are virtual machines. There's a load balancer, so that will take traffic and redirect it to an underlying droplet or VM. You can do that, I think, a round robin, so it does each droplet in turn, or a least connections, least sessions type model. And there's a cloud firewall, which is like, if anyone's familiar with AWS, it's like their security groups. You can basically say, you define a load of rules. So port 80 is allowed through, port 443 is allowed through, port 22. And then you can say, that firewall applies to this set of nodes or this node or droplet. Those are the three things that are being used. So to bring that up in a repeatable way, I'm using Terraform. Terraform's got a few modules which will talk directly to the DigitalOcean API. You can also talk directly, as in, you can use curl and so on to do that, and you can post values to the API and bring up nodes that way. But I also do that using Vagrant. But for this, for a sort of production bit of infrastructure, I'm using Terraform. So in about half a day, I wrote the Terraform code that they need to bring up a new server and its associated load balancer and firewalls. Things to do going forward are parameterizing that a bit, so I can provide a set of variables say the domain of the website, the name of the database, and things like that, and just spin up as many nodes as are needed for them to do their thing. Then we've got the problem of deployment, how to deploy the code onto the servers. The developers are quite used to SSHing into the servers, mainly because they haven't had a sysadmin, a full-time sysadmin, really. So they're kind of logging onto servers, debugging problems. They haven't really got a dev environment and a live environment, not really in the way that they're automating deployments to those environments. So, yeah, there's a lot of work to be done there, and hopefully I can bring stuff that I've been learning over the last few years to them. Maybe they it would be good to introduce them to Circle CI or Travis. I've already suggested quite a few software as a service type things to them, like, for instance, log aggregation. I could go in there and recommend that I set up an Elasticsearch or Greylog server, but I think they may be better off with just shipping their logs to a company that will analyze them and present them, and they pay them a certain amount per month. All these things remain to be seen, so it's quite exciting, sort of new client, new opportunities to try things out. They need their monitoring sorted out as well. DigitalOcean has a monitoring API, so maybe I can use that. So yeah, it's all very exciting.
I actually did my first API call, kind of reference or RESTful API.
All right.
The other day, have you used something called Swagger?
Okay, I have heard of that. I think I ended up looking it up because someone mentioned something like that.
I used it to basically generate myself an API key, and I could use it to basically pull the data from this application that I've set up. It had an API into it, so we were trying to pull back how much data they've been backing up, and basically if they restore something, they get charged for the backup software provided by an API, so which we could basically get one of the developers to pull that information from.
So it says here UI for visualizing APIs, and there's Swagger Hub for hosting API documentation.
So my understanding of what Swagger does is it's a way of documenting how you interface with an API. So if you were ever used to kind of the way that you'd work with a SOAP API, SOAP RPC based system, you could effectively ask it. You could connect to it, like it's, I can't remember the proper terminology now before it, but it was like a discovery service, and the discovery service would describe, you know, this API looks like this, it contains this, you know, it will return these values. Swagger seems to be kind of the RESTful version of that SOAP discovery API service. So it's like a standard way of describing what an API looks like. And again, in the way we were talking before about unit testing, you can ensure that your API, you know, matches certain activities through Swagger. And you can also do stuff like validate that the requests you're going to make to an API will work because they match the API kind of description file. You can put and this is from memory, so again, if it's wrong, it's wrong. I'm sorry. I think you can put like a Swagger interface between your web service and your API. So it will almost like proxy the requests and make sure that you're allowed to do certain things before it even gets through to the API.
That sounds cool. And when I've been interacting with APIs recently, I've been using curl and JQ to find my way through them. Well, specifically the DigitalOcean API. I've done a couple of things with that. I wrote something which would query the DigitalOcean API for the IPs of droplets, and then I think I may have mentioned it in an earlier podcast. Take the names of the droplets and the IPs of droplets and put them into my Zanomi DNS service, so I can then address my DigitalOcean nodes via DNS. Because you read it into an answerable variable, and then you can use that answerable variable to fill in the necessary values in the other API call.
The other thing I've been dealing with is I've been speaking to Wayne from the Binary Time podcast and helping him out with his MikroTik. Probably heard me talk about MikroTiks before. It's kind of like it's a quite inexpensive router firewall, and you can do loads of things on like MPLS, VPNs, IP6, IP4. And the one thing with the MikroTiks is the firewalls rule set on them. It can be very confusing. So I was helping him kind of understand the firewall rule set. And doing this actually helped me work out, because I never really understand about the inputs and forward chains, which I'm guessing is something to do with IP tables, the kind of concept.
I saw the discussion on the Telegram group, and at first I thought I was looking at a spreadsheet of like an Excel spreadsheet or whatever with IP tables rules on it.
Yeah.
It looks so similar to IP tables. So
me and Wayne spent 2 hours on Wednesday night going through his setup, because it wasn't working how he was expecting it. And by default, now in terms of MikroTiks, don't have a, if there's no deny all rule at the end, it will pass the traffic through the router. So it basically is like an open firewall.
I think that's if your input chain is allow, the policy is allow, then that will happen. If it's drop, then all the rules there will allow things through, and everything else will be dropped.
There's two rule sets on the file on this MikroTik. It's called input and forward. Forward means passing traffic through the router. So if you've, like I've got mine set up as an app router to go onto the internet, any traffic going out will be a forward rule. Any traffic coming into through the firewall, like I got my web server and my mail, that's called the forward rule. And you then got the input rule, which is basically anything which is ending on the MikroTik. So that's things like your web interface to manage it. If you've got a DNS server running on it, you can then write rules, so who can access and who can't access. So, and it's quite a good little thing to know, is about the way I kind of think of it, is like a kind of like the way the firewall rules work, is that I always kind of have a deny rule at the end of the chain. And this is mainly on what you get on the Cisco ASAs and on the Juniper boxes I've used, and on the kind of the MikroTiks, is I always start with having a deny rule right at the bottom of the table. And I always think of it like kind of like a funnel at the top, so that the data is coming in the top of the funnel, and then you put firewall rules in depending what you want the traffic to do. So if you want to say that it's coming at the top, and I've always, with the MikroTik, you do something called you allow establish and a related connections to be passed through, because it's basically just less intensive on the CPU of the board. So I like to have it like, I think of it like it's like a funnel, so that depending on when your firewall rules are, it gets like pushed to the right, it gets allowed. If you deny, it gets pushed to the left, kind of thing. So as it goes down the tunnel, the further and further it goes, if the traffic's allowed, it will get pushed to the right. But if it keeps going down until it hits, none of those rules match because of the things you've got, which you don't want those packets to be allowed, then it hits as a deny rule, and then it pushes it to the left, and it, obviously the packet gets dropped, kind of thing. So that's how I always think about firewall rules.
I had that. I mean, I actually use default allow, and then a reject at the bottom of the chain, the input chain. Because I had that's when I first worked out that was how, what it was doing and how it was working. That was a bit of a revelation to me. So that's the way I do it at the moment. The other thing is, if you flush all the rules by accident, for instance, everything's allowed and you don't lock yourself out. If you flush all the rules and you've got drop, then you have to log in manually or have some kind of out of band way to log in, because you're not getting in through SSH.
Yeah, luckily with the microticks, there's a box you can tick when you logged in on the, well, I don't know if you can do it through the web console, but on the Winbox you can tick a box as safe mode, so that if you make a muck up in it, saying it will revert to the last known good backup.
There's a thing on Debian called iptables-apply, which will implement your rules for 15 seconds. And if you're still logged in, then you can say, yes, keep the rules. If you're not, it will revert them after 15 seconds, I think, so that you get your connectivity back. But that's one of the things that's not on CentOS 6, which is another reason that I hate CentOS 6.
Nice. So, it's not quite the same as what you guys have been talking about, but I actually wrote a blog post a couple of weeks back, sort of describing what my standard firewall policies tend to look like. I don't know. I might link to that into the blog post. It's not specific to, in fact, it's not at all tailored to IP tables. It's more kind of sort of a generic firewall policy. But yeah, I'll link to that, and maybe people can sort of pull that apart and tell me that I'm doing it all wrong, because, you know, I'm sure I do the same to other people.
No, it's good to put in, because I was reading some like best practices today for firewalls, and they recommend that your most hit rules will allow you should have most more to the top of your list, because then it's taking less CPU, because obviously it's got if you've got multiple rules above it, it's got to go through all those rules first before it hits your rule to go out.
Yeah, so we use a piece of software at work that will look at the policy, and it will make recommendations around, you know, the way you order your policy. The thing that tends to knock those sorts of things sideways a little bit is that if you've got any rules that have got the word any in them, so any inbound, a lot of the commercial firewall products will actually, because it can't narrow the sources down, it'll actually, the first time it hits that, it will reduce the overall throughput that you can get through the firewall. There is a bit of a black art to how you can organize policy. But genuinely speaking, unless you're running multi-gigabit throughput interfaces, or you're expecting massive number of concurrent connections, the bulk of the time, actually, the order of the policy doesn't really matter. I've only really seen policies on a couple of commercial vendors, on a couple of commercial devices, where they've basically been sweating the assets. They've got like massively out of date devices that they're running effectively just to save them upgrading the kit anymore. So they don't really need they're basically just running it's like running a 386 box and expecting it to still be as performant as everything else you've got in your estate. That's the kind of thing I'd be looking at it like.
I think we had an email in, haven't we, from someone, I think, before we wrap up.
Hi, guys. First of all, thanks for the great podcast. I work for a small IT support company providing outsourced support for local businesses that range in size between 6 and 150 users. Historically, the majority of our networks are very simple setups with a single SBS server, which I think is Small Business Server.
It's a Microsoft server.
Yeah. I've been tasked with migrating these sites onto a more modern platform as SBS 2011 is rapidly approaching end of life. My initial thought was to move a lot of these businesses onto a cloud-hosted platform, and Azure seemed to be the obvious choice. Where I'm struggling is in the pricing of Azure virtual machines. Aha, welcome to the cloud. It seems to me that to spin up anything with a half-decent specification, I'm thinking a minimum of 4 vCPUs and 32 gigabytes of RAM, disk space requirements will vary per customer, it's going to cost several hundred pounds per month. And I just can't see how we can justify that cost to our customers. when compared to an on-premise server essentials or even standard solution, Azure seems ridiculously expensive. I appreciate that Azure offers flexibility and takes away a lot of the management overhead, but I think this is going to be a hard sell for our smaller businesses. I'm having the same issue when pricing up Office 365 compared to a local Exchange server. With any more than a dozen users, Office 365 pricing doesn't look very attractive over a 3 to 5 year period. I guess what I'm asking is, do you think that cloud services like Azure or Office 365 are justifiable for smaller businesses, or are on-premise servers still the way to go? Thanks in advance. P.S. I've just listened to episode 67, VPNs. I found the following video on Diffie-Hellman Key Exchange valuable when I was studying IPsec VPNs. And there's a URL there, which we'll put in the show notes. You also mentioned home backup solutions towards the end of the episode. I've been a CrashPlan customer for around 7 years now, and unfortunately we've had to part ways due to the recent price increase. I've moved my backup solution over to iDrive, as they currently have an offer of 90% off for existing CrashPlan customers. So I'm getting up to 5 terabytes of storage for just $8 for the year. The software is simple to install and easy to configure. It certainly looks feature-packed from a business perspective too, with agents for SQL, Exchange, etc. That's from James Day. So, hi James, thanks for writing in. And what do you guys think of the issues he's raised?
I come across it all the time because I'm always quoting and stuff to replace customers, our smaller customers, with Azure stuff. And everyone thinks the Azure is cheap, but then you look at it and it's expensive compared to what you'd have on-prem. But you have also got to think about things like you haven't got to worry about the power, you haven't got to worry about patching it or anything because someone else is taking all that kind of control. But also with Azure, you remember you've got to make it highly available because it's not... Because the idea of these whole Azure AWS is that we've spoken before, is that everything is meant to be highly available. You're meant to design that in your product. So I was quoting up a Tiffany system the other day, you've got to have like two servers so that if they take one of the racks down, the other server will keep up. So it isn't cheap to have these things on site. The only people who really like for small customers is things like accountants, because they like to pay a monthly fee rather than have to do the old CapEx versus the OpEx again. They always like the bit where they have to pay every little bit of the month. And the other thing you can look at doing is looking at for someone. There's providers out there who provide you with an RDS connection to their platform, and you haven't got to worry about hosting your own Exchange server or hosting your own SQL server, because they provide you with a remote desktop connection to it, and they provide the back end, and you haven't got to worry about provisioning a server for you. With Office 365, I think it's a no-brainer. For a small customer, if you look at the price, because obviously with SBS is the small business server, which is basically all the products Microsoft do in one box, which is your Windows box, Exchange for your email and things like DNS and DHCP, all in one box. So the last edition we've got is SBS 2011, which actually is running Windows Server 28 R2 plus Exchange 2010, and obviously Exchange 2010 has got so they have a 10-year lifespan, and obviously 10 years is going to be 2020, so that's going to be out of support. And obviously there's no direct replacement for SBS, so you'd have to go and buy an Exchange server license plus your CALs plus your server to host it, your backup software, your whole management of an SBS box, where Office 365 will just provide you with the everything you need to do. You haven't got to worry about doing updates. I mean, it's not just Office 365 you've got to think about. You get SharePoint as well, so you can do all your documents, so your OneDrive. And a lot of things that we're using today is that the company which we've been moved into is use Skype and Team for Business all the time. So everyone has a headset now, and it just takes it. We'd work in a company with like 300 people, it's just so much easier to communicate with each other. You could send them a message, have a quick call, you could arrange common calls with your customers by just creating an Outlook appointment. And even for like a small company of 20 users, if you've got people on the road, I think it just makes it. And we've got where you basically have it so offered 365, so you could actually make outgoing calls to anything. And we've got DDIs coming in, and it works kind of really well, kind of thing. So there's not really an answer to go. It's just it's from a customer point of view. Some customers like the thing of having their server online, but some of them want the word cloud. It's just basically working out which is the best way to go for a price, really.
The other thing as well to bear in mind, and this is not so much around the Office 365, but around the virtual machines, is that a lot of people approach cloud in the wrong way. They approach cloud as, I want to co-locate my service in Microsoft's data center or AWS's data center. Downside to approaching a migration like that is that you're actually setting yourself up for the most expensive way of using Azure and AWS, because you're going into it basically doubling your overhead. You've got to manage your servers. You've got to run the application on the servers. You've got to run the virtual networks that it's connected to. You've got to protect all the applications. What AWS and Azure really want you to do instead is to approach it as an application platform rather than an infrastructure platform. Now, don't get me wrong, Microsoft will absolutely take your money from you if you want to run, like you said, a 4-core 32 gig of RAM VM to run Exchange on it, or if you want to run a SharePoint service on your own infrastructure, on your own servers in their cloud.
I think they actually, just out of interest, at least about a year ago, for the larger kind of boxes, they do actually work out cheaper than something like AWS. Not, you know, it's still a lot of money, but the like GCP and AWS will be more for the same amount of resources.
I'm not saying you can't use a bigger box, because, you know, what I'm saying is, what they want you to do really is, rather than running a Windows box with SharePoint on it, they want you to be running SharePoint on their platform as a service.
Yeah.
Or your web service in an IIS container in Azure. And that will reduce your CPU requirements. It will reduce your RAM requirements, because you're not having to run the whole OS underneath it. You're just running your application. The other thing that gives you as well is it gives you the ability to scale out on demand horizontally. So if you only run services between 9 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you can have like a single server for your database, or, you know, two servers for your database. And then at 8:45 in the morning, you can have a task set up. I think you can do it natively inside some of the platforms, or you can have like external services that literally their only job is to fire up the provisioning role to scale up from, you know, your one server that's just got the database, the persistent data in it, up to, you know, 5 web servers or 5 RDS servers or 5 whatever it is you need, to just scale that stuff up for the time you need it. And then at 5:15 in the evening, shut everything down again. So you can achieve your cost savings and things like that as well, if you really need to treat it as infrastructure co-located in Azure's data center.
Yeah, kind of like lift and basically, you've got to think about lift and shift, isn't it? There,
yeah.
You've got to think about, I mean, a lot of customers we always deal with now is like, we ask them, what are your main applications? Is there a cloud provider? What does it? Like, we had a customer this week who's like, they have a scheduling system online. So they found a scheduling system to scheduling their resources. Like, you can now get Sage online, so you haven't got to have that locally. You can just start moving more and more stuff to cloud, because as you can, accountants like the monthly cost. And you haven't got, like this week, we had a customer who basically Windows 7 is coming end of life next year, isn't it? 2020. Their application they've got, their account package doesn't support anything above Windows 7. And she's really worried that this PC she's got now about a warranty, that what happens. So we were looking at replacing her Windows 7 machine with a Windows 10 machine. And then, but I said, I always check, can you go and check with your supplier if it's worked for Windows 10? Her version didn't. And it's going to cost them $3,000 to upgrade their software because they haven't upgraded it for like 5 or 6 years or whatever. So, but then we can't, with the latest processors, you can't run Windows 7 on them. So you'd have, but if you like pay that monthly fee, you're going to get the latest and greatest product.
Changing tack slightly, just going through the rest of the content that's in that email. The video that is referenced about Diffie-Hellman key exchange, absolutely, I would agree wholeheartedly. I tried to give a talk at OggCamp 2 or 3 years ago about public key cryptography and IPsec VPNs, and actually the whole inspiration of that talk was that YouTube video. And when it all went horribly wrong, and it is the talk that we never speak of because of how badly wrong it went, effectively I just put that video on.
And the person from Mozilla was there, wasn't there, as well?
Yeah, that's why we don't talk about it. On the home backup solutions thing as well, that's really good, really useful information. In fact, I'm going to go away and have a look at iDrive myself now, because that looks quite good.
I've actually, on the subjects of home backups as well, I've just started to use Restic with Backblaze. So Restic, just briefly, it's a Linux, possibly Mac OS as well, command line thing. I believe it's written in Go, like all the best tools are these days. It's a simple backup tool. It has a concept of repositories. So you define a repository. The repository has a password, and that's pretty much it. There has been a study done by a sort of independent party, not the guy that wrote it, around the encryption that they use to ensure that once you pour data into this repository, it is encrypted, and you can kind of store it wherever you like because the encryption is good. So it's got the ability to use different backends to back up your data to. Just going through the docs a bit, you can have local repository, so just another directory, maybe an NFS mounted directory or something like that. SFTP is supported. They've got their own server called a REST server, which is basically like a REST API, which you can point at over HTTP. Amazon S3, something called Minio server. Maybe some of our listeners have heard of that. OpenStack Swift, which I guess is an OpenStack service. John would know. Backblaze, which is the one I use, which presents a nice simple API. Microsoft Azure Blob Storage, which I guess is like an S3 analog, Google Cloud Storage, and other services via rClone. So you can call this other backup utility called rClone, which supports a few more things. So the repository is, it basically lets you look back at snapshots that you've taken at a particular time. It'll do things like incremental backup, so it'll only back up the data that's changed, and it's a nice Unixy little utility. Basically, I'm configuring it. I've written an Ansible role, which I'll put on. I think it might already be in my GitHub repo, which I'll put a link to. It gets Ansible to generate a random password, basically per box that it's backing up or per host. Which I thought that was probably the best way to do it, so that the password isn't stored anywhere else. If you lose the password, you lose access to the repo, so it's probably worth putting it in something like LastPass or KeyPass or something like that, or Pass itself, just so you don't lose access to your backup data. I backed up my laptop with it for the first time in a good long time, so I feel a bit more confident about my data now. And yeah, it's I tested out a restore with it. I don't know if it's the main method, but a way that you can do that is you fuse mount the backup, and then you can just copy files over from the mount where it's mounted to, which is pretty cool. So it mounts it on your file system read only, but you're actually going to the repository, and you can go back in time. So say you deleted a file, you can go and grab that file. And what I'm going to do with this is I've got one client who's paying me to do backups for them every month. At the moment, this is going to my dedicated server, so I don't touch it in case I lose this client's backups. So from now on, with their backups going to Backblaze, I'll be able to do other exciting things with my server. More show topics in the future to do with my lovely server that's going to be free to play with. I recommend Restic. Give it a try if you're on Linux or whatever. Tell me what you think.
Looks really interesting, actually. I'm going to have a bit of a play with it myself. One of the things that you mentioned in that spiel was about your Ansible modules that you've been creating. Which has reminded me about another thing that I wanted to mention in our any other business section, which was actually to do with the IPv6 thing I was talking about before. Obviously, in the last show, I was talking quite some length about the various vagrant, about the fact that I was running my IPv6 gateway on my Raspberry Pi. I actually then put my Raspberry Pi too close to a heater and it all went horribly wrong. So I've actually now took the opportunity to re-architect what I was doing to use Vagrant and VirtualBox and Ansible. So the blog post that I linked to has basically got a big blob at the top of it saying, note, this has now been superseded. So if anyone's looking for stuff about how to do IPv6 on Raspberry Pi, it's still there, but that's not what I'm doing at home anymore. So that stuff's not going to be updated anymore.
So you're running it in a virtual box now then?
I am indeed. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One of which is actually to do with something that's not going to be something I'll talk about at the moment, but I'm looking to start using things like NTOP and catching NetFlows. And I wanted to be able to easily provision and spin up and spin down stuff to do with that. And I couldn't really see an easy way of doing that. But also as well, the main problem I was conscious of having was the fact that this Raspberry Pi is obviously bandwidth limited. And if I was having both my ingress and egress traffic on the same interface, on a already bandwidth limited interface, I was going to hit some issues. So the fact that the virtual machine server that I've got running is a gig interface and it goes into the back of the router with a gig interface meant that I wasn't going to have any slowdown on that. And actually, as soon as I moved it over, whereas before I think I mentioned that I was losing about 10 megasecond by going over the Raspberry Pi, I'm actually down to losing something like about half a megasecond on the going through the VM system rather than going through the Raspberry Pi now.
That's not bad. Are you, just out of interest, are you using Linux for the hypervisor stuff?
Yeah.
If you are, I'd recommend going with KVM. It's just a lot simpler and you can use it with Vagrant and so on. Unless you've probably got all your VirtualBox stuff set up now, but it's I just found it's for spinning up Vagrant on macOS or Windows, you do need something like VirtualBox, but Linux has KVM kind of built in, and it's quite simple to set up with Vagrant.
So I tried to run KVM because you're right. Everyone says, "Oh God, don't use VirtualBox. It's rubbish. Performance on Linux is rubbish." And in fact, everyone that uses VirtualBox on Windows says, "Oh my God, performance of VirtualBox on Windows is rubbish as well." So yeah, I did try because I wanted to swap to using KVM, and actually I struggled lots and lots and lots to try and move to anything that would support KVM. If you've got any guides or documentation on setting up KVM, yeah, that would be really useful.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few Vagrant boxes that are KVM, but enough to get going with. Like there's Ubuntu ones and CentOS and so on. So we'll talk offline, as they say.
Yeah. So I think we're probably at the end of the show.
As always, thank you, Dave, for the audio production.
Yeah, I think last month he was an absolute legend, because we had a peeking behind the curtain somewhat. We had all sorts of issues with last month's recording, and Dave managed to. I think he's still got at least some of his hair. He didn't manage to pull it all out, but yeah, he had a real effort last time. So,
yeah.
as always, thank you so much, Dave. You are an absolute legend. Thank you very much.
And rest assured, I remember to click the record button this time.
Shh, don't tell everyone what you did wrong.
Anything else? Patrons, I'm guessing we've still got the name number of our patrons. Really appreciate it every month.
Oh, hang on, we need to name them because that's part of their agreement. Bob?
So we got Andamo, Yannick and Dave. Thanks very much, guys.
I think that's it. So thanks for listening, guys, and we'll see you all again soon.
Bye.
See you later.